And turn with me to Esther chapter 5. Now it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace across from the king's house, while the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house, facing the entrance of the house. So it was, when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, that she found favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you up to half the kingdom." So Esther answered, "If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, that he may do as Esther has said." So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. Please be seated. The premise of the story of Esther is the salvation of the Jews from complete annihilation at the hands of a single Persian man by the name of Haman. And Haman was driven by racial hatred. That's probably the best way to put it. He was just driven by racial hatred. And it was keyed up by a Jewish man by the name of Mordecai, who refused to bow to him as in his proper position as the highest in the court of King Xerxes. So because of this hatred of one man, he was willing to destroy the entire population of 15 million Jews throughout the entire empire, the entire Medo-Persian Empire. And as part of that, through subtle manipulation, he got the king to sign this decree allowing all Jews, including women and children, to be killed, to be completely destroyed, and their possessions looted on a certain day in the future. And they cast lots in order to determine when that future was going to be, and it was 11 months from the time of the declaration. Now, the problem is that if this were allowed to occur, if the Jews were annihilated, they were completely wiped out, which was a very real possibility because the Medo-Persian Empire took up from India all the way into Egypt, and it was 127 provinces, and it contained pretty much the entirety of the Jewish population. So if all these Jews were annihilated, it would make God a liar. It would have made him a liar to Adam when he promised salvation in the garden. It would have made him a liar to Abraham, who he promised that his descendants would be as countless as the stars, as countless as the sands of grain on the in the sea, and that he would be a blessing to many nations. He would be a liar to Moses. He would be a liar to David when he said that it is from your heritage, it's from your seed that the Messiah will come. And to the world, he would have been a liar to the world that salvation would come at all, and that, more importantly, that it would come from the Jews in the person of the Messiah. So in order for this to happen, it would have made God a liar. So God was going to move on this. He was going to keep his promise, and that's an important point in the book of Esther, is that he always keeps his promise. His word is solid. His word is good. So while that might be the premise of the story of Esther, the point of the story of Esther is found in 4:14, where Mordecai, speaking to his cousin, the queen, Esther, says, "For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise from the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" God's will is going to be accomplished. Without you, in spite of you, or through you. It is for this that you were brought to this place, and it is now time to step up. And we talked about that a lot last week. What is the this in your life that God has called you to? For such a time as this, it is no accident that you are alive in 2013 in Northern Kentucky. It is no accident at all. So for such a time as this, maybe the Lord is preparing you for that time, and or maybe this is it. But now is the time to step up and say, "Lord, I'm here." Think at this point all that God arranged in the story. That we've already read through. God arranged for Queen Vashti to lose her place and for a competition to replace her. God arranged for Esther to enter that competition, and he arranged special favor for Esther among the other women and amongst all the people in the court, and then eventually for her to be chosen as the queen. God arranged for Mordecai to have access to both Esther and the affairs of the kingdom at a very, very high level. So he gave him favor in the kingdom of Medo-Persians. God arranged that this lot was cast, not for a month, 2 months, 10 months, but 11 months, warning before the evil event that was to occur when all these Jews were going to be destroyed. God arranged the decree command that the Jews be killed by private hands instead of the army of the Medo-Persians, which would have been a lot more difficult to stop. So while neither God is not mentioned in the book of Esther, neither is prayer for that matter, neither is sacrifice, neither are miracles, we see his hand in it everywhere. A lot of people take solace in the fact that his name is spelled out four different places throughout the book of Esther as anagrams in the Hebrew text. And a lot of scribes, in those scrolls, you would see them put the letters in bold so they could be seen more clearly. Whenever a Gentile was speaking, it was backwards. Whenever a Jew was speaking, it was forwards in the Hebrew mind. So it still would have been backwards for us. But while God is not mentioned, he certainly is there in the subtext. He most certainly is seen in the movements of these things. Now, we have a tendency, and I think our desire is, I don't know if it's because of maybe it's a lack of faith, maybe it's a lack of assurance, maybe it's just a desire to see the supernatural, to see the excitement of it. But we have a tendency to think of the acts of God in terms of the miraculous. I believe in the miraculous. I absolutely believe in it. I've seen the miraculous, and I don't want to think that that's being diminished at all. But the miraculous is an unexpected end because of a supernatural intervention outside of natural law. Think in terms of when the Lord made the sun stand still, when he split the Red Sea, when he healed the blind, when he healed the lame, when he healed the crippled, when he, there are so many miracles, when he changed the water into wine, all these things were outside of natural law. So what we call miracles today, such as birth, such as near accidents, my case that my spouse is still with me, we shouldn't call those miracles, but we should look at those in awe, and we should look at those in wonder because of the natural order put forth by an amazing God and for the love that he continues to pour into us. So we should, on a daily basis, be looking at this as an amazing thing. It says even in Hebrews that, who are we that you would even consider us? And so as we live our lives in the supernaturally natural, we begin to think of God in terms of awesome wonder. And that's where worship comes from. That's where obedience comes from. The miracles that Jesus performed and subsequently the apostles were to illustrate spiritual principles more than the temporary well-being of others. Whenever he fed the crowds, they were going to be hungry again. Whenever they healed somebody, eventually they were going to die. So this wasn't a permanent fix. It was to illustrate a spiritual principle. It wasn't to make us better here on earth. It was to prepare us for heaven. More often than not, the Lord continues moving the world along according to his will and providence within the construct and the laws that he put forth already. That's why we're not to seek signs and wonders, but we are to seek daily, long obedience to the Lord. Day after day, we are to seek obedience to the Lord. We're to seek submission to the Lord. Daily surrender over a long period of time. And again, I don't want to deny the miraculous. And I think we should ask for it in times of great trial. God, we know that you can. We ask that you would change the circumstances, change what's going on in my body or in my life, change what's going on in the world. We know that you can. We ask that you would. And I know that those things will happen, but the miraculous is not, you know, getting up in the morning and realizing that you haven't prepared for the test that you're supposed to take, or you're prepared for the presentation that you're supposed to make, or prepared for the thing you're supposed to do at work, or the thing you're supposed to do for your that you've committed to somebody else, and you wake up in the morning and you go, oh no, Lord, can you do this for me? He's not an errand boy. But we are to look for the miraculous in those times when, Lord, it's only you that can intervene. But on a daily basis, it's about daily surrender. It's about obedience over a long period of time. We have the freedom to be part of his plan. We have the freedom to be outside of his plan. But his will is imminent. His will is unstoppable. It's going to happen. Whether we're in causing it, we're a part of it, or we're actually opposed to it. So I don't worry too much about, you know, when prominent people raise up, or, you know, this whole atheist movement, for example, that's coming up, it troubles my soul because there are people going to hell. But it doesn't bother me that they're going to somehow overcome God. We have the freedom to be part of his plan or outside of it, but his will is imminent and unstoppable. So just in the case of Esther, Just in the case of Esther, our refusal to participate could mean the destruction of ourselves and our families. Our willing participation as his children comes with daily obedience and openness to those moments of divine opportunity. Esther was used when she realized this, when she realized this is indeed my time. And she was willing to surrender her life to save her people. She said, I will go to the king, and if I perish, I perish. So Esther carried a very bold attitude towards her mission, and she was determined to be obedient no matter what the cost. Mordecai knew that God had promoted this orphan in exile for a reason, and Esther must have the courage and the wisdom to see that reason and to fulfill it, and so he helped her do that. And we're often in the position, you know, we should be in a position as older Christians to help those who are struggling to say, hey man, this is what God has been trying to point you in the direction of, and this is the time. This is the time to step up. So this principle applies to us also. God promotes us or puts us in a place for a reason, and we need the courage and wisdom to see that reason and to walk in it. And those decisions are made in the daily prayer closet, in the daily surrender. Rarely do we have the Damascus moments that Paul encountered when his life was completely turned around because the Lord met him in the middle of the road and knocked him to the ground and blinded him. We don't have those moments too often. Sometimes we might, and I am not denying that. Maybe the Lord has changed your heart and your life in that way before. But you see what happened with Paul afterwards was a daily surrender and a daily obedience. And I know he was crying out, you know, Lord, I would be okay if you released me from this prison. But at the same time, he was worshiping him. So in verses 1 through 5, what we see here then is that Esther invites both King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, we'll call him, and Haman to this royal banquet. And she puts on her robes and she comes into the king's palace. And so she shows her courage and her willingness to appear before the king without being summoned. You know, and this takes special courage because Xerxes was not known for having a good reputation for treating his queens well, obviously. He banned Vashti, you know, in a drunken stupor because she dared to say no to him. You know, this is, again, remember, this is the same guy that whenever he had a bridge built and the bridge failed because an ocean storm came in, or this would have been the Mediterranean, excuse me. The Mediterranean storm came in, knocked off the bridge. He killed all of the people that worked on the bridge, and then he had people go out and beat the water and throw handcuffs into the water as if to punish the sea. I'm sure some of you work for those kind of bosses. But this is the way this guy works. So she is treading lightly and dangerously. And she says, if it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared. And so she's not blurting out her ultimate request right away. You know, she's not come running in and saying, do you know what Haman's doing? She courts the king, if you will, no pun intended. And so she first wants to win the king's confidence in her, and she wants Haman at the banquet because ultimately she wants him to be there. She wants to accuse this man to his face. So the king says, what is your petition? Up to half of my kingdom. Now, she also knows that if she were truly to ask for half of her kingdom, then he probably would have removed her head. It was a nicety, you know. So up to half my kingdom, just trying to show his generosity. So she says, I would like for you and Haman to come to the banquet, which I'm prepared for you today. And then tomorrow I'll do as the king has said. So she's putting off this request for one more day. She's promising to reveal her petition at the second banquet on the next day. So this is clearly tactical on the part of the Lord. This is the Lord in action. You know, it's clearly tactical because a lot of things are going to happen in the next 24 hours that he is putting into place. Esther has delayed this as part of an overall strategy that came as a result, I believe, it's implied in the scripture, that came as a result of fasting by her and the Jews in Shushan. Because remember, she had asked Haman, please, or excuse me, Mordecai. She had asked Mordecai, please have everybody in Shushan, the citadel, the capital city, to fast, all the Jews, and I'm going to fast as well. Because we need to figure out what's going to happen. So 3 days have transpired. She has now this overall strategy. And I believe that came from fasting and prayer. And I believe that the fasting was also done in accordance with Isaiah, that chains might be broken and lives might be saved. So then we switch to another scene. Haman. He's been invited to a lunch, a private banquet with the king and the queen. So he's got to be feeling pretty good. He's just been promoted. You know, things are looking good. He's a ridiculously wealthy man. He has all that he possibly could. He has wealth, he has power, he has fame, all that he could possibly want. And yet this Mordecai, that one guy, will not bow down to me. So he's furious. And he restrains himself from action against Mordecai and says he goes home and he vents to his wife and his friends. He says, look, man, I've got the world at my feet. We are the largest empire in the world, and I've got the empire at my feet. And yet this one guy. So he's honored by both the king and queen of Persia, and yet the disapproval of one man makes him feel worthless. And I think that's an accurate description of how empty the rewards of this world are. You know, he's at all of this at his feet, and he still bothers him that this one person. You know, and we can take that upon ourselves as well when we say, you know, as we look around and as we take stock of all that God has given us and all the how amazing he is to us, and yet there's this one thing that's out of joint, and it just really bugs you, and that's what you concentrate on, you know. So his wife says, you know what? Get rid of the guy. Yeah, we know that, you know, your plan's intact. The Jews are going to be all slaughtered in 11 months, but just get rid of this guy. Why don't you go ahead and build a gallows, build it 75 feet high and hang him. Two things. First of all, 75 feet high. Think about that for a moment. That's a lot of hoisting. I mean, it's a flagpole. You don't do that to hang somebody. You do that to make an example of them. And I'm not going to get into too much detail, but when they say hanging, they don't mean hanging, they mean impaling. 75 feet up, that's what they want this. That's what they want to do with this guy. And he's, you know, I say this often to my wife, but not for the same reason. That's such a wonderful idea, honey. Thank you so much. That's a great idea. So let's switch scenes. Now, all of a sudden, and again, God continues to work. And the king has a sleepless night. And he calls for the official records of the kingdom. You know, that would certainly put me to sleep. Quick story, there's a neighbor of ours that called us one time and said, you know, I'm just really having a restless time. I just can't seem to go to sleep. And, you know, I'm just really troubled. This is a true story. And so I said, well, you know, I just happened to teach on that, about the restlessness in our hearts and anxiety. And so I gave her a tape of one of my messages and said, just really encourage you to listen to that. She came back, you know, said, thank you so much. I was listening to that thing for 5 minutes and was sound asleep. So, and then she realized what she said and didn't retract it, but anyway, so the king, he calls for the official records of the kingdom, and he picks up this volume that had the account of Mordecai saving the king from a plot to kill him. And he looks and says, wait a minute, did we do anything to thank this guy, Mordecai? Anything at all? And no, nothing has been done to thank him. Well, this needs to be addressed. Again, this remarkable example of providence in action. King Xerxes cannot sleep, and so he can choose from anything. He can bring in the latest bands. He can bring in whatever he can bring in one of the women from his 400 harems or 400 women in his harems. He can do anything he wants as a diversion on this sleepless night. But he says, "Bring me the books. I want to read the accounts of the kingdom." And he gets this one volume with Mordecai in it. The book could have been open to any page, but it was open to the exact page of the story of Mordecai and how he saved the king from assassination. The Lord is in this every step of the way. So King Xerxes says, you know what? We really need to reward this guy. You know, he shows some rare integrity. He says, we really need to reward this guy Mordecai. So then as he's thinking about this, he says, who's here in the kingdom? Who's here in the citadel? Who's here in the palace? I said, well, Haman is here at the moment. So Haman's excited. You know, he's, oh, happy day. You know, he gets to go to the banquet with the king and the queen. He's got this Mordecai situation taken care of. You know, he's going to hang the guy. The gallows are being built. He's a happy, happy man. He's showing up to work early. Somebody says, I need to dispatch this immediately. Who's here that can help me take care of this? And so it's Haman. So, if the book of Esther shows us anything, it shows us that God manages the affairs of men even without their knowledge. He knows what he's doing. There's no coincidences or surprises in heaven's realm. Now, we have difficulty, of course, when bad things are happening to us. And that's when we have to rely upon Romans 8:28 and 29. That all things are to the good for those who love God and are the called according to his purpose, that we might indeed be shaped into the image of his son Jesus. But sometimes it's difficult as he's shaping us or directing us in these ways. Sometimes it becomes very difficult to see that. So we have to remember what's going on in the courts of heaven as well as what's going on in the courts of our own home and our own lives. So Xerxes asks a question of Haman. I love this question. What shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? Who does Haman think he's talking about? So the Lord is now directing things so not only will the Jews be protected, Mordecai is going to get what he deserves. Haman's definitely going to get what he deserves. And so Haman thinks in his mind, you know, being arrogant that he is, who would the king delight to honor more than me? So God is using the sinful pride of Haman in order to trap him. That's something we need to avoid at all costs, is to allow pride to trap us in any way. So Haman says, oh, how should the king honor the man who pleases the king? Put on a royal robe. Put him on a horse that's been ridden by you. Give him a parade. Have somebody walk in front of the horses in this parade and proclaim what this man has done that honors the king so much, and so the king is going to honor him. And so he says, that's a great idea. Go do that. So Haman now has to put on to Mordecai this royal robe. He has to put him on a horse, and he's the one that has to walk in front of the horse singing the praises of this man that he has built a gallows for to kill. How's he going to kill him now? Would you not have loved to see Haman's face at that moment? I don't know how much blood is in the face, but I would imagine it would have been interesting to see it all pool in his feet as just everything drained. So the ultimate humiliation was for Haman to honor Mordecai in such a public way. And humiliation is only really humiliation when it is public. God is in this. He's pushing this forward. So Haman goes back home, and he is just, I mean, his day has been shot now. I mean, I can't believe that I woke up this morning just a couple of hours ago, and now look what it is that I'm doing. And so he goes back to his home, and his wife warns him. He says, you're not going to prevail against Mordecai. You need to drop this plan immediately. This is not going to happen. And about that time, some guards come in, and they say, sir, you're expected at the banquet for the king and the queen. Now is the time to come. And so he hurries off to the banquet. And so Esther, in chapter 7, verses 1 through 4, she makes her request. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther, and on the second day at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request up to half the kingdom? It shall be done. Then Queen Esther answered and said, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy would never compensate for the king's loss. So she invites them to a banquet, and at the banquet, he says, what is it you'd like? And she says, come tomorrow and I'll tell you, for another banquet. And now she's here and she's finally gives her request. And this really is troubling the king. It's like, who is threatening you and your people? Who's this wicked man? She says, let my life be given at my petition and my people at my request. My apologies. So when she finally made a request, she showed some great tact. She didn't immediately and identify herself as a Jew targeted for massacre. Even as Haman hid the identity of the group he targeted when he made his request, she didn't just say, well, I'm a Jew, and Haman has decided to kill all the Jews. So she also shows wisdom in how she framed a request. She appeals on a personal basis, and she says, King, you know me. You've expressed your love to me. I've never done anything to displease you. All I've ever done is please you. So I'm asking on my behalf. So he says, who is this wicked man? And so King Ahasuerus answered, and he says to Queen Esther, who is he, where is he, and who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing? You know, maybe Xerxes should have known that he was the one that, you know, maybe connected the dots and said, oh, I think I may be involved here. Because he's the one who gave authorization to Haman to carry out the plot, even though it was done in ignorance. So Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. Again, would you not have loved to see his face? Interestingly enough, the numeric value in Hebrew of the phrase "this wicked Haman." Anybody get any guess? 666. So he's identified not as a faithful servant of the king, but he's called an adversary and an enemy. He's more interested in his own fame and status than the benefit of the king. Now, why Haman didn't make the connection between Mordecai and Esther, I don't know. But he never imagined that Esther was a Jew. And so now he's standing before the king, very rightly accused. And he has nothing to say to defend himself. Now, this staging process, if you will, you know, it maximized the impact on both the king and upon Haman himself. It created this sense of suspense. But there's also a godliness in the timing, for sure. The Lord was behind this. So the king is furious. He jumps up and he runs out of the banquet hall. He's just seething, and I think he's trying to just consider all of this in his mind. Haman is just dumbfounded. He goes to, I love this, he goes to appeal to the queen, knocks her over on the couch. The king comes back in, sees Haman laying on top of his wife, and is like, "What is this? Now you're trying to assault the queen? So, and in my house?" So what do? They come up. No questions, no orders or anything. The guys come up, put a bag over Haman's head, and take him out. Somebody points out, "Hey, you know what? There's a gallows that was being built by Haman, 75 feet high. Why don't we use that? It's already built. Great idea." So Haman is hung on the very gallows that he had built. This satisfies the king. So Haman found his end on the same instrument that he had intended for the death of Mordecai. He was caught in his own trap. It says in Psalm 7, verses 14 through 16, "Behold, the wicked brings forth iniquity. Yes, he conceives trouble and brings forth falsehood. He made a pit and dug it out, has fallen into the ditch which he made. His trouble shall return upon his own head, and his violent dealing shall come down on his own crown." There's not room for hatred in our heart for anybody. And even the wicked, we have to know what their end is. And that gives us the compassion to pray for them instead of hate them. Because while we go into glory, they go into destruction, even in their own lives, before they even get to heaven. And perhaps the greatest example of this, and certainly an exception to the point that I just made, the greatest example of this was when Satan thought he won by getting the crowd to crucify Jesus, but it was the cross that turned out to be the instrument of his defeat. So after a period of fasting, and I believe prayer, God arranged for Esther to delay her request, first asking for a banquet with the king and then another banquet, and in that 24 hours, God arranged that Haman restrain his anger, not kill Mordecai immediately. God arranged for Haman's anger to come to a peak on that one particular day. God arranged for Haman's anger to drive him to build a gallows to hang Mordecai on that particular day. At that time, God arranged for Xerxes to have a sleepless night, to pick up a certain book in that sleepless night, to read the passage about Mordecai in that particular book. Mordecai then, in that 24 hours, is honored publicly by Haman. And then the queen exposes Haman, and he is hanged on his own gallows. 24 hours. What a difference a day makes. At that time, Haman's home is given to Esther. His position is given to Mordecai. For Esther had told how he was related to her in chapter 8. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, gave it to Mordecai, and Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. So this man who had seemingly achieved everything ended with nothing. He didn't even have anything to pass on to his family. Think of how hard Haman had to work to achieve all that he did, and yet it was all a waste. Everything that he worked for was now gone, including his life. Solomon tells us in Ecclesiastes, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. Did you hear that? Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. So Esther then says, okay, well, Haman's taken care of, but King, we still have this other problem. This other problem is that in months from now, there's going to be a day when you have, in Persian law, in a way that cannot be reversed, you have ordered that all the civilians can go kill any Jew that they want, man, woman, or child, and they can take whatever possessions that Jew has. Where does that leave me, King? So King Xerxes makes this counter decree, allowing the Jews to protect themselves on the day they were scheduled for annihilation. And it says, a copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province, published for all people, so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. The couriers who rode on royal houses went out, hastened, and pressed on by the king's command, and the decree was issued in Shushan, the citadel. So again, he couldn't revoke the previous decree, so he simply made another decree, you know, giving support to the Jews against their attackers, again, who were private citizens, not trained militia. So it was neighbor against neighbor. So this whole confusion about one law contradicting another is not new to us. Governments have been doing it for a long time. But in this case, it was good. So, verse 15, Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, with a great crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. So he's raised up as the prime minister, as a replacement for Haman. He is the second in command over the entire province. Excuse me, the entire empire. And in verse 16, it says, the Jews had light and gladness. And again, we're in chapter 8. And so this joy came before the actual day. And this is important. This joy came before the actual day appointed when the Jews would be attacked, yet able to defend themselves. They knew that this day was coming. They knew that there would be a time that they would need to fight. But because of the decree of the king, they could be assured of victory. They could rejoice in it ahead of time. They not only had the assurance of the king, but also his princes throughout the 127 provinces also were on the side of the Jews at the order of the king. So they were giving them all that they needed. They were supplying them with arms. So, but in the same way, it says light and gladness, joy and honor. In the same way, our course is not yet run. Our salvation, while assured, is not yet complete. But we too, today, can rejoice because of our confidence in our King. In Philippians 1:6, this is being confident of this very thing, that he who has begun a good work in you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. There will be battles. There will be times when God equips us in such a way where we will have to engage in the fight. But we are assured victory. We are assured victory. And so we don't have to wait for that day. We can know it today. And it says that because of that, many of the people in the land became Jews. As they saw God working on behalf of his people, they wanted the same relationship with the Lord. You know, your God must be much more powerful, because that day finally came, and an enemy came, you know, neighbor came against neighbor, and there, the account is that, you know, that the Jews were just slaughtering them, just absolutely slaughtering them. But it's important to also understand that they never took any of their possessions. So many of the people of the land said, hey, because of what your God does in your life, can you tell me about your God? Isn't that what we're supposed to be doing? When we walk in victory, isn't that exactly the kind of thing that happens? Your life is different. What shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? It says, in Shushan, the citadel, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. The 10 sons of Haman they killed, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. So then in verses 11 through 17 of chapter 8, chapter 9, verses 11 through 17, Esther asked for the complete defeat of all the enemies of the Jews. Hey, can we do this again tomorrow? Is basically what she said. Can we do this again tomorrow? And then, by the way, Haman's 10 sons are dead, but you know what? Let's put them prominently in the gallows. Some would say that that's a little heavy-handed. I don't know. You know, the Lord allowed it. I'm just going to go with it, as reported, without comment. So there's this great celebration of Jews among the Persian empires, and that says in verses 18 and 19, but the Jews who were at Shushan assembled together on the 13th day as well as on the 14th, and on the 15th of the month they rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore, the Jews of the villages who dwelt in the unwalled town celebrated the 14th day of the month of Adar with gladness and feasting as a holiday and for sending presents to one another. So this is the institution of the Feast of Purim, and it was actually a decree that was set forth by Mordecai in verses 20 through 32. I'm not going to read all of that. But starting in verse 20, and Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters to all the Jews near and far who in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to establish among them that they should celebrate yearly the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar as the days on which the Jews had rest from their enemies, as the month which was turned from sorrow to joy for them and from mourning to a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and joy, of sending presents to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews accepted the custom which they had begun, as Mordecai had written to them, because Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to annihilate them, and had cast Pur, that is Lot, to consume them and destroy them. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letter that this wicked plot which Haman had devised against the Jews should turn on his own head, and that he and his sons should be hanged on the gallows. So they called these days Purim, after the name Pur. So Mordecai wrote this out. He sent this letter to all the Jews all over. He says, look, we're going to make this an annual celebration. And the principle, of course, is remembering God's great deliverance. You know, we too often forget his great works. And it's good to remember these things. I think with a purity of heart, you know, I think that's where the institution of celebrating Christmas came, really. You know, in the heart of the Christian, was to memorialize the fact that Jesus was given to us as a baby, you know. And so it is good to remember these things. The question is, how do we remember these things and how do we observe them? And just like anything else, you know, even today, this unfortunately has been corrupted by the majority of folks in Israel. The majority of Israel, by the way, is secular. It's not Jewish in faith. It's Jewish in culture. But it's celebrated nationwide, and it looks a whole lot more like Halloween than it does anything else. Today, it's one of the more popular Jewish feasts. You know, and there's costumes and games and noise, and it happens in February or March, depending upon the timing. But part of it is the complete reading of the story of Esther during this time. And whenever Haman's name is mentioned, everybody starts hissing and booing and stomping, you know. But and I find it interesting. Benjamin Netanyahu is not known as a man of faith, not at all. Prime Minister of Israel, he's not known as a man of faith. But yet, over the last couple of years, he's been in Bible studies. I honestly don't know the man's heart. You know, whenever we chat, we don't really talk about that, you know. So, but he's been reading the Bible. 2 years ago, he presented a scroll of the book of Esther to our own president during Purim and stated that Ahmadinejad was not the first Persian trying to wipe out the Jews. It is still something that they celebrate today in remembrance of the deliverance of God. So in chapter 10, then, I can sum that up with one sentence: Mordecai is promoted to the position of second in the kingdom, and he is honored throughout the entire empire. So how do we take this home? You didn't think I could do this in an hour, did you? How do we take this home? The book of Esther shows how the hand of God can move in a supernaturally natural way. It's a record of God's direction without miracles, and it sets it apart from many accounts where God does use the miraculous. And it's important because really that's where we live in the day-to-day. You know, God's hand in history never rules out our actions. The actions of Esther were Esther's. The actions of Mordecai were Mordecai's. They were critical, very critical, to the preservation of the people of God, but they were still their own actions. God's will is accomplished, yet men are free to do what they want. Haman did as he wanted, and God used it. Xerxes did as he wanted, and God used him. So did Mordecai and Esther. We see no interference. We don't see coercion. God's not twisting any arms. They do their will. They bear full responsibility for it, yet God works out his eternal plan for all the ages. This is important to me. This concept is extremely important to me because when I was 16 years old, what I hung the entirety of my relationship with God on is, how can a God, a loving God, raise up a man like Judas specifically to satisfy his own passion play so Jesus can be hung on a cross so we can be saved, but yet this man is destroyed? How can a loving God do that? And because of that, that's the argument that I use to hang my faith up and just say, I'm done. And I spent the next 13, 14 years declaring myself and living very much as an atheist, very much like a man who decided there was no God. And so I was going to take part in everything that pleased me because this was all there was. One of the first things that God brought me to when he finally grabbed my heart was that Judas had a free will. Judas could do what Judas needed to do. He also had an opportunity for redemption. And yet his heart was so wicked. His heart was so much, and he had another agenda, that he never surrendered his own heart to Jesus, even though he walked with him for 3 years. Man can do what man will do. They are responsible ultimately for their own salvation. As God continues to pour into their hearts the desire that he has for them, it is their responsibility to respond, and they will be held accountable. For not responding, they will be held accountable for their own actions. It's amazing. This is an amazing case study, if you can think of it that way. Esther is an amazing case study of how God's sovereignty and man's free will being both in contrast and cooperation. Another point that can be made out of this is that God, in his wise and providential plan, allows people to be tested, sometimes severely so. Esther was severely tested. Mordecai was severely tested. And we can't just suppose that because we're servants of God that everything's just going to be okay and that, that everything's just going to work out fine. That phrase in the English language, to me, is one of the most frightening that we can offer to anybody. It's going to be fine. It may not be fine. But if it's God's will, praise the Lord for it. I might suffer because of this, but I'm willing to recognize that. Because trials are a part of God's design. Mordecai refused to bow to Haman because of his integrity. It brought him a trial. Esther, she wakes up in the morning, everything's good. By the afternoon, she realizes she has to go into the king and risk her life. And then even as she goes to the king and risks her life, if he says okay, she still might expose herself as a Jew and risk her life. This was an accumulation of days of faithfulness. We all desire to hear the Lord say, "Well done, good and faithful servant." Don't we? We want to hear that. "Well done, good and faithful servant. You were faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord." We understand that to be a statement referring to our final meeting with the Lord before we come into eternity. We understand that to be that judgment seat, if you will, for Christians, you know, where he says, you know, and as we're looking into his face, he says, "Well done, good and faithful servant." And while this does apply to the end of our days, what it speaks to is a daily good and a daily faithful. We don't live our lives as if everything is okay, and then on that last day, we get it all together. Now, praise the Lord, those who live and live wickedly throughout the entirety of their life and on their deathbed receiving Christ can come into glory just as much as we can if we were saved at 7 years old. That's not my point. My point is, when the Lord looks at us and says, "Well done, good and faithful servant," what he's saying is that you have been doing it for a long time. Come in. Rest. The Lord's going to give to those to whom he sees doing those things that he's called us to do. As we were talking about this Thursday night, in 2 Chronicles 16:9, it says, "For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is loyal to him." You do daily what God is calling you to do. He will pour into your life to continue to do. You want to do things for God? Do them on a daily basis. You don't give anything to a person who you know is just going to set it down and ignore it. You've got something that needs to be done that you've asked another person to do, whether you're a manager or you're a parent or a friend or anything else, and you say, "Hey, I could really use your help here. Can you do this for me?" You don't give that to somebody who says, yeah, no problem, and then they stick it in their drawer and it never gets touched. You know, the next time, that's not the person you go to. Why are we any different when it comes to the Lord? He doesn't need us, but he wants to use us. He finds us faithful on a daily basis, doing the things that he has called us to do. He says, "Hey, I got something I want you to do," and prepare to be blown away. Prepare maybe even to see the miraculous. Daily faithfulness, daily good. So the last thing that I want to say is that just as the Jews took comfort in Esther being queen and Mordecai second in command, we too rejoice because the Lord our Savior sits on his throne at the right hand of God. And we can look to that daily and say, "Lord, I know that I can be obedient. I know I can love you. I know I can love your commands. I know I can love your people because you're on the throne. You've equipped me. Even in the battles, you've equipped me. And I will be victorious. And by the way, when I'm victorious, I don't need to take on the spoils of that win, because there's nothing this earth can possibly offer me that you have not already given me as a heavenly riches." So let's stand, if you would, please.